I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Okay, thanks guys so much for coming. And obviously thank you so much for having me and for doing this with for all of us. So I'm going to let you guys introduce the book. I just want to give the big headline. I think the fact that bowled everybody over is the fact that it's not just genre fiction, but it is like a combination of several genres. It works across traditional genre distinctions in a, what I would argue is a really innovative and exciting way. It's exactly the kind of book that I want to see written these days, where not very many people take risks in terms of like branching out of their literary fiction category or out of their very strict sci-fi category if it's a genre writer. So what I love about it is that this sort of like works across all sorts of different genres, and that's why I think this is a super courageous and actually important book. Do you want to say, we can get back to the genre stuff a bit later to begin with. Do you just want to kind of roughly describe what the original intention for the book was?
Oof.
And how it turned out differently, as is the way?
Well, I mean, talk about the genesis of this book, which, you know, we kind of have a lockdown to thank for that.
Absolutely.
Both of us were stuck at home in our respective countries. And I'd known Sin for about 13 years as a Twitter friend. Twitter.
That's not what it's
called.
Let's
not talk about Elon.
It's called Twitter.
And we met really through friends who were talking about Doctor Who a lot in 2010. That basically happened a lot then. Everyone was talking about Doctor Who.
Everybody had,
we had strong opinions.
Yeah.
And then we didn't really talk much for a long time.
For about 10 years.
I think once I aggressively sent you a Star Wars t-shirt.
Yeah, you very much aggressively sent me a Star Wars t-shirt. I was just looking at Star Wars t-shirts on Twitter, and Helen turns up and says, I can get that for you. Talked to Helen beforehand, and so that happened. And then we were friends properly from then.
So we just started talking a lot during a lockdown. And, you know, that kind of weird sense that we were all isolated. And, you know, I was a nature writer. I couldn't go to Midway Atoll to research my next book. It was impossible for me to go to a remote island of the Pacific. And so, you know, everyone else was like discovering nature, and I was basically refusing nature. I basically sat on my couch and I watched television and cried and ate ice cream.
Perfect.
As a hermit and did fuck all, basically, except talk to Sin about all the things that we both loved in terms of genre fiction.
Yeah, we were watching a lot of TV, a lot of Netflix. I was playing a lot of video games.
Yeah,
we were going through all the different books that we wished had more to, like, we wanted everything that we loved felt like it was missing something a little bit extra. And we were in the middle of lockdown. We could do whatever we wanted, and we could create whatever we wanted. And so we did that.
Yeah, one day I was like, Sin, I'm thinking, you know, I can't really write this nature book. Do you want to write a novella with me?
That wasn't what happened. Well, what happened?
Like novella, the book is like 500 pages.
Words.
What happened was, is like I want to write this. Can you help me get to the place with dialogue and characters?
Yeah, because you're this genius with dialogue. This person, genuinely.
So that sounded like fun, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a novella. It won't be a novella.
It will be 40,000 words. Yeah. Bastard was right.
Hate it.
But we were talking a lot about nostalgia at the time.
We were.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, we really quickly realized that we wanted it to be a big love story.
Yeah,
we wanted it to be socially sort of, you know, a real kind of social critique and quite political, but fun.
Yeah.
And nostalgia seems such an extraordinary thing to sort of talk about at this time. You know, we had the whole kind of, you know, the way that kind of everything was going to be tipping towards fascism, and the way that the past is recruited to, as a kind of safe space at that point. So that was like right the way through politics of the time. And one of the things I think I feel really strongly about is that one of the problems of today is that we don't really, it's very hard to have a believable future It's very hard to imagine a believable, livable future.
Everything's so hopeless.
Everything's so hopeless. So
and regurgitated.
Like, you know, everything has to look back on some golden age, which can be inflected by corporate interests, by consumerism, by Hollywood, by politics. You know, it's a very unstable and frightening situation. So we're like, well, let's do it. Let's do weaponized nostalgia.
Absolutely. It was the only thing that we could think about at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a really hugely complicated conceptual apparatus, though, in the book about nostalgia. That's like an entire little philosophy, a nostalgia philosophy. Like in the book, isn't it?
It started off as a military disease. That's what we were laughing about. You know, it started off. It was.
Yeah, I mean, and that's in there. Is that like? Is that actual history?
Yeah,
it's sort of a genealogy.
There's a little bit of confusion as to whether or not this chap Johannes Hofer in this 18th century really did coin this term, but he coined this term nostalgia to relate to Swiss mercenaries who were far from home in the battlefield and began to get really sick, and they saw ghosts and heard voices, and they got very listless. And, you know, the cures that the military advised then were pain and opium. So we made Rao, one of our characters, a masochistic addict.
Yes.
We thought that would fit.
Yeah.
And then it kind of, you know, became like really kind of buoyed up in romanticism. It became much more acceptable. Nostalgia.
And it became a nationalistic tool.
Yeah, nationalistic tool.
Yeah.
So, you know, we thought, you know, this is the kind of moment on Facebook when you see when you're presented with a picture of a chocolate bar from your youth and you feel that little pang. You're like, oh, I remember those Spangles. It's showing my age.
Yeah.
And you want to engage. You want to press the like button. And we just turned that moment of engagement into a situation where if you are touched by this peculiar element in the book, I'm giving a bit of a spoiler here, you spontaneously suffer kind of psychic trauma that makes you create the object that you yearn to. Really
and then you
possess.
Cannot.
And then you get stuck to it. Yeah. You can't let
that's go. Like one of the main tropes, isn't it? I don't think that's a spoiler. That's like the key conceit in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. So you get sort of, you know, you hug your teddy bear from when you were a child.
Catatonia,
And if it gets taken away, then you die of literally of a broken heart. So
and people spontaneously produce elements that are connected to their most nostalgic sensitivity in a way, or however you want to call it.
Whatever produces a sense of safety.
Yeah,
because that's really what you're looking for whenever, you know, a politician or a commercial or a movie pangs this nostalgic feeling. You're looking for safety. This is what you know. This is the past. And wasn't it pleasant? Wasn't it safe? Wasn't it easy?
And it's a trap.
Yeah, so that's what we did.
That was our political.
So this sort of key idea of the idea of weaponizing nostalgia, that was there pretty early on. Right. In the process,
that was day one. But that was also we knew it wanted to. We wanted it to be a giant love story.
Yeah, because if you ask me, I mean that is what it is.
It's deep, it's absolutely.
It's a big romance.
It's a big romance. Yeah. A sci-fi, whatever. It's like a little, I'm joking.
No, it is a big
sci-fi, but it's just the emotional center of it is a massive, one of the best love stories. I mean, I've read recently. I mean, it's really incredible. Because, okay, let's go to the love story. Have you guys read it already or are you yet to read it? The love story is, read it, it's just for the love story. It's doing that classic thing. I mean, it's a classic setup whereby the two people are obviously, to begin with, seemingly incompatible entirely.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
So they're total counterparts.
Yeah. And it's the odd couple.
It's the odd couple.
Right, but
the opposite, like the oddest couple. Like,
okay, let me describe the characters.
Yeah, describe the characters.
We have two characters, and I'm going to describe Rao because, you know, I did end up in, I don't know, I kind of, I felt more comfortable writing Rao.
Okay, yeah, that's
mainly because I can't do American dialogue.
It's not one of your strengths.
No. I kept writing these, like, sharp military lines, and Cinna be like, that sounds like Jane Austen.
Did.
No subjunctives. Like, okay.
So, too many hads.
So Sunil Rao, he's great. He's a British Asian guy who grew up in a really sort of wealthy family based in Jaipur, grew up in London, went to Oxford, which he thought was awful.
Went to Cambridge.
Same thing.
And then he went to Oxford.
Did he go to?
Yeah. Oh, so. We better check because I can't remember now. They're both awful though, so that's fine. He's a Cambridge graduate. So yeah, he did the Oxbridge thing, ended up going off the rails, you know, spending a lot of time in Berlin, drugs, sex, everything, just losing it. And the reason he really went off the rails is that Rao has this incredible talent. We went a bit supernatural for this. He has the ability to know whether any statement about the world is true or false, any propositional statement. So it's not like a lie detector. It's like genuinely knowing what's true is what's false. And that really messed him up. He ends up working for MI6. They send him over to Afghanistan to ground truth interrogations in a CIA black prison. That ends up very badly for Rao. It really breaks him. And then when we first meet him, he's being sprung from prison to help with this mysterious situation here. So Rao is a mess. I adore him. He's sarcastic.
Foul-mouthed.
Foul-mouthed.
Flamboyant.
Flamboyant, brilliant, nightmarish person. Yeah. And I'd die for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is the truth-telling that we put into the book for Rao is also something that we wanted to look into. We started writing this in 2020.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, you know, the whole misinformation and fake news and alternative facts and stuff like that. And everybody was either looking for a truth or looking for a lie or looking for something that settled with them as a truth.
Yeah.
And we wanted to talk about what pure truth would do to a person.
Yeah.
And how that would look. Like, yes, we all want that, but like, never being able to be lied to.
Yeah. Imagine growing up and not understanding initially that people lie. Don't know they're being lied to. They don't know they're lying. I mean,
a lot of people wouldn't know that they're lying.
Imagine a romantic history, you know?
Yeah.
Not good. Yeah. So anyway, so that's Rao.
Yeah, exactly. And then the big thing is how that ability hangs together with
Adam Rubinstein.
Exactly, yeah. The other guy.
Who is a military man, through and through. He's difficult to read, not only by Rao, who can't read truth from Adam, but...
Tries him up the wall.
Yeah.
He's the one person. It's a little bit like Twilight, and Rao can't read Adam. Yeah.
But it's the one person who can't read. So that's the one person in the whole world.
But he's also famous within his milieu that he's difficult to read. Right.
Yeah.
We adore Adam as well.
We do. He's basically the Dorothy of Rao's Toto.
Rao's Toto.
So we love him. You know, really sensitive kid, grew up in a military family, got completely messed up by a very authoritarian father, and is now this terrifying military figure.
He's great.
He's very cool.
He's doing well.
Yeah. So he's babysitting Rao. He's taking Rao around doing missions. And so I thought maybe we could maybe read
that. That's
the
perfect
bit.
Moment, exactly.
Yeah. Should we read a bit? So this is Adam's point of view when he first meets Rao in a meeting. I mean, this is so fun. I can't believe we wrote this book.
Be cool.
I'm cool.
You can get a lot out of a person from how they present themselves. Sunil Rao was the type of mess you'd seen a bunch of times before in crypto analysts. Guys like that get cut a lot of slack because of what they can do. They push back, make a point of it. The file he'd been giving suggested Sunil Rao wouldn't be easy to handle. The meeting confirmed it. Rao talked incessantly, told unrelated anecdotes and jokes. The jokes were pretty funny, considering, but wildly inappropriate in context. Adam quickly put most of this down to him having taken some kind of stimulant. His pupils were dilated and he found it hard to sit still. Kept brushing the arm of his chair with his palms, drumming the desk with his fingers. Half an hour in, he took some gum and chewed it for so long and so energetically that Adam's own jaw started to feel uncomfortable. After the meeting, Rao came up to him and told him, conspiratorially, that he didn't have to believe all of the stuff in his file. "I have to take it on trust," Adam replied. Rao laughed. "Trust, yeah. Very, very important concept, Adam." "It is, Mr. Rao." "So it's very important, you know, you don't lie to me." Adam blinked. "I don't intend to." "Good, good. How old are you?" 35. Rao shook his head in wonderment. "Fucking hell. Have you been to London before?" "Yes." "Are you in London now?" Adam frowned. "I am." "Am I?" He hadn't answered that, just stared at Rao, and Rao had laughed, high and hysterical. Which was when Adam reassessed his previous assessment, slotted this operation into the category potentially very difficult.
It was, and it wasn't. Several weeks in the field proved Rao was as chaotic and uncontrolled as Adam had predicted. He waved his arms a lot, scratched his head compulsively, always laughed at his own jokes. It always looked like he was wearing someone else's clothes. He was uncomfortable with silence, had to fill it with words, hum tunes, snapping fingers. And there was a degree of oppositional behavior. It wasn't directed at Adam, but sometimes that made it worse. Operationally, however, he was superb. First, he was a natural at soft interrogation. It was fun to watch how quickly people trusted him who shouldn't. Adam knew the mechanics, but there was more to it than tone, word choice, and body language. There was something intangible involved, a form of finger Spitzengefühl that couldn't be learned if you didn't already have it, and Adam never had. Second, Rao's Russian was flawless, and from the pace of the conversations he heard, his Uzbek nowhere near as bad as Rao insisted. Third, no matter how much vodka he drank, Rao's reports were admirably clear and concise. One evening, Rao had told him the trick, smugly tapping one temple. "I'm cursed," he said, "with perfect recall and a photographic memory. It's awful." Most of all, Adam had been impressed by Rao's specialism. They'd informed him Rao worked like a polygraph, but his numbers were better, said he was near infallible, which sounded bullshit. Predictable bullshit. Adam had long been entertained by how much of a hard-on certain sectors have for supernatural intel. It'd be so much cheaper if they could only ever get it to work. They never could. Like those phonies holding their temples in Fort Meade back in the 60s, trying to put Soviet missile silos on bits of unexposed film. Should we stop?
I like the next page.
Should we keep going?
Going.
All right. I don't want to go out outstanding welcome and reading. But the evidence stacked up day by day, and eventually Adam couldn't deny it. Rao could tell when assets were lying, when Department of Defense personnel and embassy staff were lying. Waiters, taxi drivers, receptionists, anyone. But maybe he needed to concentrate to do it because he wasn't infallible and it wasn't all the time. Adam had lied to Rao a bunch of times and he hadn't seemed to notice. On a Bukhara backstreet, listening to Rao complaining bitterly about how some cruel fluke of fate had deprived him of the excellent driving skills that everyone else in his family possessed, Adam tested him again, informed him deadpan that their vehicle had gone. Gone? As in stolen? Shit, this isn't good. What are we going to do? We have to be on the road. Rao stopped, then glared. You're fucking with me. I am. Adam was very familiar with the kind of person who could dish it out and not take it. He hadn't thought Rao was among their number, but he must have been wrong because Rao was suddenly furious. You're just another tool in the kit, is it? He spat out.
What?
I just can't tell how you're doing it, that's all. I need to know. Years of training in marksmanship, close quarters and hand-to-hand. No, not the creepy stalker hitman stuff. I'm not. How are you doing it? Rao, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to talk in full, complete sentences. Please attach as much information to these sentences as you can. Get fucked, Rao said. Seriously. As you can tell, writing this book was so much fun. Yeah. It felt illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, quite often it'd be like, oh.
I mean, sorry. This is a really, really, really cool bit to read, actually, because the point you're giving, we said sci-fi earlier, we said romance earlier, whatever. But actually, I mean, the thing is, is a character-driven novel, isn't it? Yeah. It is primarily about these two characters. That is sort of what it is. And backstories for especially one of the characters, like really detailed flashbacks in a way.
Yeah.
And that sort of allows us to connect to these characters in the way we do. So the flashbacks are one thing, their histories, and then the other thing is their banter, their kind of the way they interact with each other.
They won't shut up, will they?
That's it. That's like so much like dialogue and so much like interaction between the two of them, and it's kind of hilarious. So it also has a ton of humor. So how did that come about?
Well, I mean, we enjoy stories that are character driven.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to really nail it down because we were looking at archetypes a lot of the time when we were writing. We were looking at archetypes, and we always came down to the fact that there was always these two types of guys. There is the straight talking, cold but you know warm on the inside, difficult, dangerous one, and then there was the chaotic whirlwind.
Yeah.
And everything.
It's everywhere, like, you know, we've got from Peep Show to With No Lie.
Yeah, Hamlet.
Disco Elysium.
Yeah, Hamlet, absolutely. Yeah. And we wanted to do that. And also, we found that, like, we only really cared about a story if we cared about the people.
Yeah. Sure. Exactly.
And so we needed to make people that we cared about.
Yeah. And I think that the one of the reasons I love the fact that these characters seem so real, I think part of that is the fact that both of us wrote them.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, and this is going to sound like maybe like we're trying to blow our own trumpets, but I don't think that's what
it's
I'm doing.
It's our launch day.
Oh, it's our launch day. I can do that.
Yeah, I think
so. I think you know, we both have a very clear Rao in our head, and both have a very clear Adam in our head. Mm. But when we write together, there's always a little bit of a gap between those two visions. And I think that gap is what makes, for us, makes them feel so alive on
the
page.
We get a different layer to the characters.
And
because,
the book is, it's built out of tropes. I mean, we basically took all the tropes from all of the things we love. Like, there's a lovely quote, I think, from the novelist Sarah Perry about the beauty, the veracity, and the power of tropes. So we put von villain stuff in there. We put kind of, weirdly flat villains, and we put
swelling music,
helicopter rides and stuff. It's all in there. But we needed, in order to make that work and to have fun with those tropes, we needed to have real people inside it. And that's
because otherwise it would seem cartoonish.
Yeah. And it also animates them exactly. Yeah. It animates them. It gives the tropes depth and it actually brings them to life. So I totally get it. I do time travel. So these things, we like these tropes because they're highly effective as narrative devices. But then they become something original by creating the characters, even though you might use stereotypes, but the dynamic between them is still reads completely fresh on the page.
Yeah, and they're very self-aware, Every so often, Rao is like, God, this is just like James Bond, what even? They're very self-aware and sort of genre-savvy too. So it's really fun to play with that,
Can you say a bit more about how exactly the writing process worked? Because that's like really hard to imagine, like what, somebody sits down one evening and sends it over to the other person.
Well, we didn't meet in person in real life until the book was nearly done.
It's
kind of bonkers, isn't it? It's unhinged.
Well, it worked out. We did it mostly over direct messages and email. We would kind of decide which way we wanted to go with it. And then we would disappear for a couple of hours, and then we'd reappear with stuff, and the other person would take it and edit it or rewrite it or do little things with dialogue. And
I just laugh at my, because I had no idea how vain I was. So like initially, I'd write stuff and then Sin would send it back and go, I don't know if that worked. And literally there was this voice going, my books have won prizes.
How dare you?
That's really shocking. Yeah. And then I've got over that. We have to be really vulnerable.
For sure. Right? It was necessary.
We had to really trust each other.
It worked out. And the way that it happened is that because we were live editing almost every single word along the way, there are parts that we know the other person at least, was the catalyst of the part.
Or wrote the original draft.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah. But we get confused. We have no idea who wrote what in some places.
We always think that the best lines are written by the other person. Yeah,
it's quite funny. Our favorite parts are these, and we'll say that was you.
Yeah. But I think one of the things that was most joyful about that too was the unexpectedness of material appearing from the other person. Yeah, so quite often, at the end of the book, the very end of the book, there's this really lovely end bit, which, I really adore. I'm not saying anything about it. we had this big argument about happy endings and sad endings. Sin really wanted his unhappy ending. And I'm like, no.
Can't stand happy endings.
So we kind of had both.
It's like sort of several endings.
Yeah, several
endings.
Like sort
of
We managed to do some
stuff. So one afternoon, just this whole ending just appeared in DMs, and I'm like, oh, there it is. It's great if you're a writer and that happens. You're like, oh, that's nice.
But I think that's a good point to make. We were writing for each other in the middle of lockdown. We were going backwards and forwards and writing this book so that the other person could read it while we were writing it.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Yeah, so we wrote the book that we wanted to read. Mm. We really like it. We hope that everybody else does.
So did you write, it was like basically on a Google Doc or something like that. Did you work in one document?
Eventually it became that. So Before that, it was a mess, terrifying. Like there were like virus files everywhere.
Exactly.
But it ended up being a Google
and
Doc.
And then you plotted out sort of when you sort of agreed where it roughly goes. And
we
then
knew the direction that we needed to go in, but we actually had a lot of fun finding out what worked and what didn't in the moment. Because there's another person working out the weird threads of narrative, then the other person would have different ideas than you. And we would go down certain paths and find out that that didn't really work. And we would go down another path and find out that didn't work and kind of merge them together. Mm-hmm. And that would end up be where we
and
were.
Other people also were involved. So like my friend Christina, who's a philosopher of language, we always like, Christina, I've got a character who knows what things are propositional truths about the world. And she was like, oh, that's interesting. So, she worked out a whole bunch of ways in which the fact that he knows what's true about the world would also mean that he would know when objects were fake because of various causal mm-hmm. sort of theories of reference. And so that was really fun.
Yeah, we got to actually sit down and really like pick at the philosophy yeah. of it yeah. and the history, like application of like Rao and his family yeah, and everything like that.
And,
yeah.
then, and then there was a lot of fun thing about, we were laughing about this before, you know, I was a historian of science, so... You know, when I thought, oh, I've got to write about special forces, shit, you know, so I'd spend like, you know, 6 weeks doing a deep dive on special forces, you know, in America. And Sin would be like, it's fiction.
It's fiction. It like, doesn't no! have to be exact. Yeah. We can have a little wiggle room.
So that was yeah, really fun.
Was interesting. Yeah. But there's always like this sort of, okay, in fiction, you can basically do what you want. Nobody tells you that, but as a novelist, I would say that's the sort of the big unspoken secret.
And
in
the
fiction,
big draw
you can
do for fiction.
What you
yeah.
want.
Yeah.
However, there is always a balance, isn't it? Yeah. Because you make a decision, you make a choice, isn't it? That you make a choice to include certain real factual mm-hmm. references yeah. that are accurate, mm-hmm. reference the real world. And this is also what's happening in the book, isn't it? Mm-hmm. There's sort of, I mentioned before, there's a whole conceptual apparatus around nostalgia. There's certain historical fiction, uh-huh. every historical uh-huh. fact uh-huh. being used uh-huh. in there.
Yep.
Like, yeah, now we learn the entire military language is accurate uh-huh. and it reads accurate as well. So
yeah.
it's about making a choice, isn't it?
How well, yeah, much, we wanted you know? It grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, we grounded, did. Yeah. We could have made something like this is pretty fantastical, but we yeah. wanted it to be something that felt real. The threats could be real because they are, and that's what we wanted to touch upon.
Yeah.
We wanted it to be fiction and fun and a romp and everything
but
else.
It starts off basically in a field in Suffolk. I mean, you can't get much more grounded yeah. than that.
No. I mean... Yeah. but yeah, we did. We wanted it to feel
yeah,
real.
Really real. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it does. Did you ever disagree on anything in the writing process? You must have at some point.
Have we put that out of our minds or do we remember anything? Are you holding on to anything?
I think the happy ending, non-happy ending.
That's a big one.
That's
we had
a big fight
about, you know, yeah, I wanted it
I
to be
really obnoxious.
Devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not yeah. having these boys being unhappy.
That is so... Okay, I'm going to let you talk. That's very highly interesting. For those of you who read the book will know what I mean. Because you can actually...
You can see where it would be the end.
Feel two people
yeah.
in
yeah,
the endings.
Funny thing is, I wrote...
you wrote the happy ending,
I wrote both.
This is great. You did.
Well, damn it.
Yeah.
and the thing about the characters is like also, like, you know, that there are sort of... this notion of explanation. So I'd love to say something about this in terms of like science fiction. So we have a very clear schema of what this weird substance is in the book and what it does, why mm-hmm. it does what it does. And we made this decision to put the book in the closed third person. So everything in the book, apart from some phone calls that are in italics, like, you know, proper Michael Crichton stuff, mm-hmm. is in the heads of our characters. So we never get an explanation. Like at the end of most sci-fi, not or many sci-fi books, there's like, okay, what is this stuff and what does it do? What's it trying to do? What's its agency? What's its purpose? We never learn that. Mm-hmm. And that was like a really interesting thing to kind of play
yeah,
with. Particularly with like,
yeah.
you know, we messed with Rao because, you know, it's really fun for the conceit of a mystery to have a character who knows what's true and what isn't. It kind of breaks that.
Mm-hmm.
And also we were really interested in like having a situation where a reader would be given lots of clues to this substance, but never get a clear answer, even though the clues are all there. And I always feel a bit like the generosity in that, like a cryptic crossword puzzle. It's not meant to be forbidding. It's like all the bits are there and you can mm-hmm. read them.
Yeah, but we trusted.
Yeah, we trusted.
We trusted everybody. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We hate it when people do that to us, you know, and try to explain things over and over again. And we didn't want to do that.
And I always think there's a kind of a bit of a sort of theological kind of reading of this too. If you look, you always laugh at me for this one.
Yes, I do. I'm yeah. doing it right now.
I think there's a kind of a theological. So, and then, you know, questions of truth and memory and stuff and all that is also kind of, you know, yeah, it's complicated.
I think that is a kind of a contemporary way, weirdly, of doing science fiction, actually, is to withhold the explanation, whereby traditionally...
Like Jeff Vandermeer, for example.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
One, he's like, yeah. What is Area X?
Even have you read the M. John Harrison, The Sunken Land?
Oh, I love his
It withholds every explanation
it's
ever.
Wonderful.
So it's in a way a sci-fi that or a horror story that withholds the horror or withholds the sci-fi. Mm.
Yeah, gorgeous.
And that gives it that sort of an... I think that gives it a greater intensity.
It's
often.
Really astonishing. It, and his light trilogy, I think, is yeah. some of my favorite... The Nova Swing ones are my favorite sci-fi.
Totally.
Wonderful. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah, he's great.
Can we talk about M. John Harrison for this entire thing?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Mike's no, lovely.
His latest
non-biography is one of the most astonishing books I've read for years. Okay, moving on.
It's about sort of withholding the scientific explanation is actually in a way like withholding the main characteristic that defines science fiction. So it's really breaking with the form a little bit, but updating it in my view and making it more intense. So
cool.
I love that about it as well. So let's talk a little bit more about the genre, because that is obviously the fascinating thing. So for you, it was a departure. For you, it was not. It was home.
I had always written fiction for me and my friends.
Yeah.
It's a hobby. I honestly can't stop. It would drive me insane if I stopped writing. And so it wasn't a huge jump for me to go into genre and to mess around with genre and mix around stuff, you know. So it wasn't... It wasn't that difficult for me to do that, and also I had written collaboratively before.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things that we like to talk about quite a lot with this book is fan fiction. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know any writers really. Maybe, like as you said, maybe not Salman Rushdie, but
Salman Rushdie, but most writers
have got.
I think Salman has a
probably
fan.
He's got
no,
a
yeah. yeah, like, AO3 you know, account.
Yeah, most writers I know have written fan fiction. They've got it all out there on the internet under false names, and you know some of the most extraordinary long form works I've read in the last sort of 20 years have been internet fan fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that whole ecosystem of work that's free, there's no money involved, and it's very, very joyful.
Yeah. But it's interesting and courageous, and that's a little bit what I was getting at earlier. It's courageous to some extent because, people might write fan fiction, but they put it out under a pseudonym because there's clearly a literary hierarchy in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
But literary fiction is at the top of the hierarchy, seen to be as the high cultural artifact is a novel. Yeah, a literary fiction mm-hmm. novel.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas then, sci-fi genre fiction is accorded a lesser value traditionally, and I like writers who disturb that hierarchy, who work sort of across this distinction. I think it's politically important. But you made a really clear decision to write now a sci-fi novel, moving away from the stuff you.
I've always read sci-fi. I mean, I was the kid. I used to read terrible Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and Amazing Magazine when I was a kid, So it's and I remember being obsessed with the short stories of J.G. Ballard when I was way too young to have been reading them. There's one called The Voices of Time, which is one of the most depressing short stories ever written. And I still remember every word, it was traumatic for me as a child, that one. So, I mean, it's all there. It's just I've never had a chance. And it wasn't until I met Sin really and started talking with Sin that I managed to think, well, I could...
And I said,
I
just do it.
And
you're a writer. You can do it.
Yeah.
There's no law.
Yeah.
You can do
There's
it.
Law against it. Cool.
Yeah. There is no law, but there is a certain there is an expectation that you confound.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite,
but it is really funny because, I used to work in the history of natural history, and I always laugh about this when this sort of sense of the highbrow, because I remember, there's some really interesting paper by John Mullen, academic who's no longer with us, and it was about the relative hierarchy of natural history pursuits. So right at the top is birds.
Yeah.
And then below that, apparently, are dragonflies.
Yeah.
So the bird people look down on the dragonfly people.
Oh, my God. Rightly so,
And then, you go down, amphibians, down there. And then, you get towards botanists. And there's a lot of respect for botanists because plants are really hard.
But that's a completely different...
Then you go down and then you get the moss people. And then right at the bottom are the liverworts.
Oh my God.
So they're at the bottom of the social hierarchy of natural history. And I always whenever I think of genre and fiction and how that works, it just makes me laugh. I always think of the liverworts people.
Yeah, no,
so,
exactly.
I'm going to be a liverworts
person. But you chose to basically leave the birds and go liverworts.
It's all in there. Yeah. It's all the animals in here. Yeah, yeah. There's lots of literary things in here, and there's lots of extremely silly things as well, and lots of philosophy. I mean, it really is. Yeah, we didn't plan it to be so. I don't know. We didn't really...
What are you saying?
It just happened.
Yeah. It was a little bit like that. We spent a lot of time being surprised that we had gotten to where we were.
And,
I think especially when we were presenting this to our agent as well, that was terrifying.
That was really funny, though. Can I
yes,
I'm
you can
tell the story. So I was, heart in mouth. My literary agent... the great Bill Clegg. You know. Also, you know, Bill has a kind of, you know, quite a colourful past life, and I was, you know, stressed about Rao as a character. You know, like, oh, Bill, you know. Anyway, so I tell him about this, and he's like, oh, that's good. Nice to know you're keeping writing. That's good. Okay. Yeah. Like, no, I really am writing a novel with Sin. He's like, okay. And then he sent him some pages, and he was like, oh, shit. I got to take this seriously. So we had this meeting, and Sin was the first time.
Up. Yeah, it was the first time that
they'd read about like a third of the book.
Yeah, we had sent them, I think, 25 chapters.
Yeah. So we were terrified. I was terrified. There was Bill in his New York office on Fifth Avenue, and I'm like, oh, shit. I'm a nature writer. And we were like, okay, we had this discussion about it, and it all seemed fine. And then I'm like, you know, I'm waiting for the thing to drop.
Yeah, right? We didn't get any criticism or notes or anger or anything. So we actually asked for some. We were like, well,
Simon,
you have to get mad at us.
Do you have any
now.
Substantive comments for us? And they were like, we think you should make Adam hotter and more dangerous.
And we were like, okay.
We can do that. Yeah. It was really great. That was a moment, I think, the sort of joy of having fun, I think, was, you know, if you have read it or you do read it, I really hope that the fun that we had comes across and is shared by you as you read it, because it was,
It was joyful.
Absolutely. I've got to write another nature book, but I really want to write another one of
another
these.
Yeah. Exactly.
We have threads we have to tie up, you know.
Yeah. Yes, there are threads.
What a literal sequel.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Guys, I think you've waited long enough. Should I hand it over to the audience? Do you want to ask some questions yourself?
Give us hell.
Don't give us
difficult
hell.
Questions.
Give me hell. Be nice.
Give hell and hell.
Hello.
Naff question to start with. If you were affected, both of you, by the virus or whatever it is, if you were affected by this thing, what would be your object?
What would be the object we'd make? I know what I'd make, and I still have it. On my kitchen windowsill are two plastic dinosaur models from the Natural History Museum. When I was a kid, my parents, they'd be arrested now. They used to go shopping in London on Saturdays, and they used to just drop me off at the museum, and I was, like, tiny. And that's where I learned all my natural history. I used to wander around all the bird galleries and learn. You know, I remember once I complained to someone because a Latin name was wrong on one of the... It was a nightmare child.
It's incredibly in character.
It's very in character. Yeah. And he was just a security guard. So, basically, I lived there. And, in fact, when the government made museums, you know, you had to pay a fee to get in. I was absolutely furious. I tried to slip in when I was in my 20s because I'm like, no, this is my house. I was really entitled. So, yeah, I have these two plastic dinosaurs. One is a Triceratops and one is a T-Rex, and one of them's got a bit of a tail missing. And they just represent that wandering in the halls of knowledge as a kid, and I adore them. Sorry, that was quite long-winded, but...
Yeah, no, that was... Yeah.
So I don't know if anybody's seen The Brave Little Toaster.
No.
I was obsessed with it. I really was. It was a huge thing for me, mainly because there's this one track called Worthless, and it goes way too hard. It's it's essentially about cars that were once deeply loved now being scrapped.
Oh, my God.
See, this is so on brand.
Yeah, well, you did yours.
All right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I suppose that was quite on brand as well. Yeah I'm going to shut up now.
I adored it. In L.A., everybody had, like, the silver toasters that was in the movie. And so my dad, who is a hobbyist artist, he got some metal paint. And he stopped the VCR at this specific place, and he painted the face of the Brave Little Toaster.
On the toaster?
On the toaster. Oh. So our toaster was the Brave Little Toaster. And when we moved, we were moving to Ireland, so the toaster wouldn't work. So we had to leave the toaster behind. Yeah. So you can imagine the trauma behind that.
That's quite sad.
It's fine. it would be the toaster that my dad painted. Yeah.
Oh my God. Why? Because the black plug didn't fit.
Yeah, the plugs. Yeah.
They're terrible.
Yeah, awful for a 6-year old.
We're all in pieces.
Is everybody okay?
Thank you. That was such a great question. Yeah,
thank you. Question.
So you touched a little bit on RAL's power and the scope of it. I've actually just finished it this morning and it was amazing. How did you make sure that the... It's very real, it's very like... It's huge, his power, but also quite contained.
Yeah.
And I just thought how skillful that was, like, handled and done well, especially with both of you writing it. Did you manage to just keep going back and being like, actually, this is too much, we need to bring it back to Earth all the time?
Thank you. Rao, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to start just by saying, you know, of course, Rao could, you know, knowing the truth about the world, you know, he could have done really well in maths. He could have done really well in pretty much any area, but he's hopeless in many ways. And his whole thing is he wants to help people, and it ends up with him joining, you know, MI6, thinking he'd be really helpful and help people. And as usual, you know, when Rao wants to help people, it's always a complete disaster. But there's a lovely bit in the book, I think, where one of the other characters says, "Why did you run out of money? Why didn't you play poker? Like, what's wrong with you?" Mm-hmm. And he just goes, it wouldn't be fair. And she's like, I don't understand what you're talking about. But he's got, like, really strong moral sense, and I think he does feel that there are some ways in which he really shouldn't.
Yeah.
He shouldn't use that.
That helped a lot. Yeah. I think that we also, we talked to Dr. Christina McLeish.
Yeah.
About, like, a lot of the things that we were writing about. It was like, would this work? Mm. Would he know this? We think he would. What do you think?
Yeah.
And she would talk for hours about the reasons why he would know and things like that. But also, directly answering it, yeah, we did have to go back over some
things. Yeah, we did. We're like, well, he would know that.
Why he would, would he say yes or maybe or...
Because, as I say, indeterminacy and vagueness are like huge things to kind of...
It was one of the last things that we had to do, actually, was to make sure that not only did he know everything as he needed to know, but he would specifically need to ask the right questions to know.
Yeah.
And how would you know what the right questions are?
How do you angle the right questions to interrogate reality?
If you don't know something already.
We just have to use language. It's really incoherent and incomplete in many ways. And also, he can't answer questions about God or gods, which is also really important in this book. So,
Or Adam.
Or Adam, yeah.
No.
So, yeah, it was really fun. Yes.
Yeah, we would love to.
Oh, my God, we never, I mean, of course we are.
Easy.
These boys won't leave us alone.
We still write little bits and pieces, like we're still writing a book, because it's fun. We had a lot of fun writing it, so we still do.
Yeah, that's going to be, sorry.
Looking at the publishers now.
I mean, what we haven't really
drawn
out yet is the thing as well, that it's obviously a gay love story.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that is, I don't even see, because it's obviously so normal for in my particular world, but it's something hugely unusual as well, I guess, that we're seeing a gay love story in a sci-fi book, because it's traditionally, again, it's such a straight...
Well, actually, that was one of the things that we really cared about, because in all the archetypal odd couples, it's implied.
Yeah.
And we're sick of that.
Yeah, we're just like, no, we're going to go full balls to the wall. Yeah. We're going to get together, damn it. I've given it away, but like, anyway, whatever. Yeah. I'm a liability, I tell you. I really am. But also I think it's really important too, you know, that Rao is an unbelievably fluid person in many ways. You know, he's clearly non-binary. He's clearly like, you know, what was the secret? I don't know what I am. I don't really stop to think about it, you know. He doesn't feel entirely Indian. He's not British, you know, he lives in this incredibly kind of complicated, and it makes him feel really sorry for himself. But that's a necessary kind of consequence of the whole of kind of the flip side of him knowing the truth about the world. And that was always going to be the case in terms of his sort of fluidity. And Adam was always going to be this, you know, extremely sensitive person who ended up through, you know, the kind of forces of his familial circumstances and society being a basically a really scary super soldier, which is not who he really, you know.
And also, I think that we're sick of, like, as much as we talk about tropes and archetypes and everything else, we're sick of specifically gay archetypes.
True.
There's always these characters that look exactly the same, and it's not fair. So we didn't want that.
Yeah.
And so in creating these real people, we... made a choice really early that this was going to be a queer story.
Yeah. And it definitely is. It's even like a plot device in a way, because the, one of them to begin with reads the other one as straight. Mm. So it's like a really classic, it's actually crucial that it's a queer love story. This would never happen, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fundamentally like built into the entire book.
And also it's really important to, you know, when we were writing this book, we really did call Adam and Rao the terrible men. Yeah. I mean, they are assholes.
They really are terrible. And it was important that, you know, because we have these things in media when people are gay in TV shows or like movies or cartoons. And they're always like, they either have to be redeemed or they have to be a good person
or
they die horribly or, jeez, it's just so exhausting. Yeah. And like sometimes people are assholes.
Yeah.
It's okay.
And they're just trying to find their way through life and do the right thing. And like, you know, so,
and also not for nothing, it's sci-fi. Sci-fi is queer.
Yeah. You know, for it's like horror. Yeah.
And it always has been. And there's no reason to hide it. So. Yeah.
It's good to draw it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still laughing about me writing horror.
It was really good horror. Yeah.
There's a bit in the book where someone gets attacked by a Kermit. I was very proud of that bit. Yeah. I hope they don't see. Any more questions? We're really enjoying this. So,
I have so many, but I'll pick one. So this is about the process, because sadly I haven't finished reading the book, so I don't want to make any judgments on that. But about the writing process, when I first heard about you to have written a book together, my first thought was, that's amazing, because every time, you know, something like this, I've never heard two people writing a book together. And the second thought was, that's horrific. I would never be able to do that. When I write, I am very personal about it. I'm very offended if anyone even takes a peek. The fights we have in our home is usually my partner trying to sneak a peek and me threatening with divorce lawyers and everything.
And rightly so.
So I would just...
We had to get over that. It was hard.
And that's my question. Yeah. How did you get over that? Because it's very personal and protective and someone coming. But then you mentioned that you got over that. And I was just wondering, what was the process of getting over that?
I think actually the big one that we had, one real big one, we thought that we had, you know, ironed out all the creases. We thought that we were cool about it. And we had like even discussed it going in. It's like, we have to deal with our egos going in. Let's be realistic about it. Let's try to set it aside and everything else. And we did discuss about how we feel when people do this, when editors go for any kind of work or readers or anything, we get very protective and weird about it. And we did talk about that, and it was fine. We had hurt feelings a little bit here and there, but
I think knowing the other person is kind of going to look after your hurt feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because we talked that through.
Yeah, we would talk about it. We were very.
I mean, it would happen maybe a day after the hurt feeling, so we would stew in it for a minute.
It's very important to feel that.
Yeah. But then, you know, a day or two afterwards, we were like, listen, I've thought about it. This is the reason why I'm upset. And the reason why I'm upset, and it's not because you have ideas or critiques or anything else. It's because these are my words. It's really hard. We're taught constantly that writing is solitary.
Yeah, the 19th century genius model, right? Yeah. It's a solitary consciousness.
Yeah.
In a garret with a candle.
Sure. And then you sit in a bathtub with cognac and you cry. But it doesn't have to be like that.
Yeah.
Because being able to yell about something that you've done, that the other person is the only person that can understand why you're yelling about it. That's really, really good and really cathartic. And so we leaned into that kind
of
thing.
We did. We leaned hard into the vulnerability. And
being honest about why we were hurt.
Ow.
Yeah.
You
that
bastard.
Sucked. Yeah. Yeah.
But... you know, eventually, I think particularly the way we edited, you know, going over and over and over, eventually all of those little hurt feelings sort of really kind of, it was a bit like sanding down a piece of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I think the book started, there was a moment, and I always feel this, before with my other books, that there's always a moment where the book stops being a production of humans at all. It becomes a creature of its own. Yeah. And that's always a lovely moment. And that happens sort of later on in the process. And once that happens, it was easier for me, because you feel like you're kind of, it's like you're feeding a horse, or you're kind of making it go somewhere rather than you're kind of building something from your
horse. It is difficult when you're when, especially when you're in the middle of writing something, you're trying to get parts of yourself out onto a page.
Yeah.
Nothing else does that. I mean, we talk about, like, I play music, I write music, and it's similar. But with fiction especially, and I think that it gets looked down on because of genre or whatever else, but what you're creating is something completely new from you. And that's vulnerable as hell.
Yeah.
Doing it is scary, let alone someone looking at it. And so, yeah, you end up in a very protective, very defensive place.
But at the same time, like, actually the two of us having written this book makes pretty much everything else about the book easier.
Yeah.
Like, doing this is a joy. Mm. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's more fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And if there are any sort of, like, you know, snipey sort of things anyone says, you know, I just go to Sin, and Sin's like, don't be an idiot, you know, it's Goodreads. So yeah. I'm still
Let
laughing. There was I was telling earlier, there was one of the Goodreads reviews. This person was so outraged by this book, hated it so much that they wrote a review about this long.
Yeah.
And they said it was disgusting. And they wrote down all the swear. They said it was like, it was full of disgusting words. And then they wrote down all the swear words.
They tallied them up.
And they tallied how many times each of them appeared in the book.
Commitment.
So there's a lot of really precise reading there. I'm going to regret.
I mean, we don't know how many cuss words are in it. They do.
Yeah. But we've been really enjoying people finding this book and having joy with it. So we really hope that you guys have fun with it too. Yeah?
They will. They will.
Anyone else? Yeah.
I had a question that sort of links onto that, which is that when you're reading so-called literary fiction, you can really often tell, or at least I find you can tell, when the non-fiction has bled in, so when this is just like cut and paste from the person's life. Mm. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm not. And I was just wondering, was this pure craft? Or were there things, bits of your emotional history baggage that you threw in and worked with as well? Or was it just the pure joy of creation?
I mean, inevitably there's going to be bits, right?
Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a promiscuous, drug-taking layabout.
That was not a layabout.
No, disaster.
Yeah.
I was a drug-taking disaster at college, but that was a long time ago. but I'm certainly much more like Rao. In terms of my general kind of chaos. And Sin is very ordered and together. So there was a sense in which the characters were a little bit easier to kind of map onto. But in terms of, like, you know, it was very easy for me in the sense of, like, you know, I gave Rao an Oxbridge education. You know, I did Oxbridge. I don't think there's anything in the book that maps directly, because so much of it was drawn with love from other works. Like, it's a work of intertextuality in that sense. So, you know, in the sense that, you know, it was kind of nostalgia for kind of Bond movies and nostalgia for kind of various fictive kind of things from my childhood came into the book. But that it's a kind of, it wasn't my life. It was just nostalgia in my life that really populated the pages. But having said that, I really enjoy the info dumps in genre fiction. So one of my favorite things that we didn't do in this book was what I call the Frederick Forsyth info dumps, right? So, like, I remember, you know, you read The Dogs of War, and, you know, one of the characters is, like, suddenly in the dodgy diamond trade, and then you have three pages of explaining what diamonds are and where they come from and how they're mined.
Yeah.
And I love that. Mm-hmm. And part of me is thinking, I really wish we could have put some of that in there. But anyway, that's my answer.
Well, I think that no matter what the book is, the writer is going to put themselves into it.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable. You're, like I said, you're putting yourself onto the page. I don't think that there's a lot of me in Adam, but that being said, I am pretty straight talking, a little bit stoic, pretty American. I didn't grow up in Las Vegas. I'm good at cards. I'm okay at lying, I guess. No, I don't know. The putting yourself into the things, I always felt like, specifically speaking about the loss and trauma that we put into the book, none of this maps directly onto our lives. But we wanted it to feel like it was real loss, real trauma, real dark times that people felt. And I think that because we're able to have those moments in our lives, and we have people in our lives that have told us those stories and everything like that, it's about gathering the feeling and then creating a place and a person and a scenario that creates the exact same feeling that we have. So maybe not the characters, maybe not the scenarios are mapped, but the feelings are exactly mapped. And that's what we created in the characters and in their backstories, I think.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I haven't read the book, so this might be a bit of a ridiculous question.
You're in trouble.
Oh, no. I've confessed. I don't know why. I feel like I've been found out. But you started the talk by mentioning how there's this feeling of hopelessness about the future, and maybe we're kind of like ill-equipped to think about the future. And I just wondered whether the process of writing the book made you feel any better equipped, or you think that reading the book might help people to think about the future in a different way.
That's a good question. Are you looking at me, Sid?
I am.
Okay, a couple of things. One is that we really felt that writing the book was kind of subversive act, really.
Yeah.
In many different ways. It wasn't what I was supposed to be writing, is one way. The queerness of it is subversive. The kind of attack on a particular strand of late capitalism is subversive. So we felt that we were kind of doing a bit there to kind of break some of the narratives. But in terms of like a believable, possible future, it's a love story, right? So my take on this is that, you know, it had to be a love story, because if everything is pointing to the fact that there's no kind of future and no progressive future and no movement forward to a livable future, everything always looks backward to a past, you know, that the only thing really, apart from collective action, which isn't in this book, that can break that is love, right? It's in the moment. It's timeless. It presupposes some form of imagined future.
Yeah.
And it's generative, and it's full of hope, right? So, you know, I think in a small way, this book presents this notion of a requirement for hope in the future, even if it doesn't politically present it. And politically, it's quite depressing in many ways. It doesn't...
In a lot of ways.
And, you know, it doesn't actually fix anything at the end of the book. It just, you know, some people are happy. Or as happy as they can be, considering. But yeah, so, I mean, it does sound quite like, you know, this is 1967 and I'm straight out of Fulton Street. But yeah, love is the answer in this one. But it's hard. It's hard trying to keep hopeful, right? I mean, you know, and I think Rebecca Solnit and many other commentators have written a lot about this. You know, we need to work really hard to open up a space for uncertainty about the future. And then, you know, working for that uncertainty about the future takes effort. It takes a lot of effort and emotional work to do that.
What Helen said.
It's really hot. I'm sweating. Yeah. Not because it was a stressful question, honestly. I'm just really hot. Thank you for it.
Yeah, shall we think? One more? Have one you got more? One more?
Tiny one.
Time. Okay. Should we?
Tiny one. It's okay.
Tiny one.
Tiny,
what if we have a really long answer?
Oh, no. I was just thinking that when I write, I realize I'm really porous, and that if a friend sends me a piece, I want to write just like them the next day. And I was wondering if you guys have a sense of how you've changed or shaped one another's writing differently.
Ooh. Mm. Oh, yeah. Maybe it's going to be really hard for me to write nature writing now.
Well, don't. That's not the question.
Yeah, we did get kind of one-mindy, didn't we, towards the end when it comes
to... Yeah, I think so. We have a joint voice, I think, is really what it comes down to. We always laugh about the fact that we can't tell now. Yeah. We said this, it really, truly, we have this single voice in the book that we hope is, you know, cohesive.
No, it is, because whenever there's a funny line, I'm always like, that was yours.
No, that's yours.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Happy fight.
But I think when we were starting to write, there's always going to be patterns that you have. I mean, you have it when you're talking. You have different patterns. Mm-hmm. You have different patterns of thinking. And so we knew that we had to either adopt some things. And like you said, like if I read something that my friend writes, I want to write like that. Mm-hmm. But we did that consciously. It was like, oh, I like that. That's a good thing to do with that prose, we want to do that.
Yeah, usually when I'm writing, I can't read anything else. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and one of the things that Ages for Hawk was really fun because I tried not to read anything. And I ended up listening to Radio Shakespeare and reading Agatha Christie. And now I read Ages for Hawk and I'm like, oh, look, it's full of those things. It's got the Agatha Christie drive and it's got all the Shakespearean language. But with Prophet, it was phenomenal because I was just listening really hard to the cadences and kind of the ways that Sin's mind was moving. Mm-hmm. And Sin was listening just as hard to mine.
Yeah.
So we really did kind of create this kind of shared consciousness of writing. Yeah,
and we learned a lot of stuff, I think, from each other as well, because I get stuck in characters and I don't really want to come out of them. I just want to keep there and what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and that tends to stagnate after a while. And Helen would create, you know, not just plot, but like vistas of atmospheres and things like that. And I can't do that. I couldn't do that. By the end of this
book, we did really learn from each other.
Yeah, we went back and forth, and that's really what we say, that we don't know the difference. It's because we learned these different ways of writing while we were writing.
Yeah. So it's like we did a sort of like, you know, bootstraps masterclass for each other in how to write a completely unhinged novel.
It's pretty hinged.
It's pretty hinged.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you.
No.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for the questions. Thanks to the two of you. And I think you guys can now purchase the novel if you haven't done so, and you can get it signed live by the two authors. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.